The Story King Podcast with Giancarlo Ghedini, a show about people and their stories. Today's episode is about marketing a book series.
Ava Sandor, welcome to the Story King Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me again, Giancarlo.
Yeah, I believe this is what, your third time, I think?
I think it is. Third time might just be the charm.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you've been up to since the last time we spoke.
I think that the last time we spoke, I was talking about writing a series because I was on my third book, and I'm happy to say that there are now four, and that brings the series to its conclusion because the way that I plan my story arcs, there are four points to hit, and I continued that tradition by having those same four points to hit in the story arc of the entire series.
And I know we spoke about that four-point thing, even for a single story. I'm finishing up a novel myself, and I always think of four parts. So, like, even, you know, you always hear about the three-act structure, but the middle act is so long that I break it up into Act 2A and Act 2B. So it's really four parts.
Exactly. And I wrote a little article about it where I find that the four parts, for me personally, are the setup. And then you have the complication. And then there is a moment, which is a question, the question that is asked and the answer that comes with it. And that is the climax. That's the turn point of the whole thing. You set it up and you complicated it to make the audience understand what's happening and why they should care. Then there's this question and this answer. And then the fourth part is what they've been listening or reading for the whole time. And that's the payoff. And the payoff contains what makes them feel a certain way. And it's that feel that the entire three preceding sections were setting up. So that's my personal four-part structure. I don't know if it coincides exactly with yours, Giancarlo, but I do have those four in my series. So I'm happy to say that it's done now. And that gives me a completed and final object, if you think of the series as one object, now to promote. I'm not asking people to come with me on a journey anymore. I'm offering it to them as a completed thing and say, hey, you can binge this if you want to now.
Right. And I want to get into all that in a little bit. As far as, the four-point thing, I think it's a shame that you know, writers are always told about the three-act structure, because I think when you think in terms of four parts, it's so much easier, especially when you think of like length, even length, you know, like everybody's always talks about, you know, the dreaded second act. But if you're thinking of like four equal parts, it's not so bad. You know, I kind of just think of, you know, I just have another turning point, you know, so I have the setup, like you say, and then I have like the inciting incident, or, you know, that launches you into Act 2A. And then I have like another turning point that launches you into Act 2B. And then, like you said, you have like the payoff, the resolution, however you want to describe it. So, but I think it's so much easier for a writer to work at the book when they're thinking in four equal parts.
Those four parts. Exactly. And they're not necessarily equal in length. I think that we have to make sure that people know that they're not equal in length per se. They're equal in importance, right?
Right.
And that there's a magic structure, they say, in terms of what people expect in length. And of course, you can play with this, but it's generally said that if you don't have your inciting incident, if your setup isn't completed by one quarter of the way through the book, people are going to start to get very antsy because they're just not used to waiting that long. And it might be worth their while. You might, if you are a good storyteller, bring them along. But generally, that first quarter, that's true. That should be one quarter of the book. But the time between that, the complication time, between that and the moment when the big question gets asked and its answer comes out based on all the things that you've brought people along with in that way, that does not necessarily fall directly in the very 50% mark of the book. That sometimes falls further along. So the lengths of them are not necessarily equal, but their importance absolutely should be equal. Yes.
Yeah, the only reason I say that, and I'm actually not conscious of the length while I'm writing at all. You know, so I don't know what you use, but I use a program called Scrivener when I'm like...
I use it too, yes.
Well, yeah. So you know how when you see in the left panel, you know, you can see... So I'll notice my 2A is like this long, and then my 2B is only like this long, you know. So like you said, the length is not necessarily correspondent, but I just think it helps if the writer's not thinking like, oh man, the two, you know, the second act has to be so long. So when you think of it like, oh, actually not really, just this, I think of it in chunks. But when you're actually writing it, it doesn't come out equal no matter what, you know. So
it will not. Yeah. And I use the, in addition to Scrivener as the actual tool, I use a method of editing called the story grid. And I believe I've spoken about it before. Yes.
Yes.
And the story grid does ask you to analyze your story very, very methodically. And one of the things that they ask you to analyze is word count. And it's for this reason that as you write, you shouldn't be worried about it. You shouldn't be thinking about it. But later on, when it comes time to edit that, you can see for yourself graphically when you look at word count, oh, the reason why I have this vague feeling that the story drags in a certain part is because, and then boop, boop, you can read exactly how many words there are. And you're like, well, yeah, of course it drags. I've got 20,000 too many words in this part.
Right.
So that it does help in that way. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to know about these editing methods and about how you set up your story arcs and your series and your development. It's so endlessly fascinating to make it as well as to read it.
Yeah. I mean, before we get into, you know, the process of writing a series and all that stuff, let's talk about your recent success. Congrats, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You know, success and being an indie author usually don't go hand in hand, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, success is how you define it, right?
Sure.
And so for me, I think what we're talking about here is the fact that I have had a lot of success recently in getting the word out.
Okay.
So this whole past year, I held off, obviously, on writing another book because it's finished now. And I promised myself that I would spend the year really going back to basics and learning how to market, because that's something that I'm not terribly good at. I'm more of a creative person. I enjoy making the thing. And once it's done, it's on to the next thing. I'm really not that great at making people get interested in it, because I'm not interested in it anymore. I'm on to the next thing, right? I want to make the next thing. But of course, you need an audience. And of course, you need people's attention on you. And the easiest thing to do to get people to become interested in a thing is to give it away. And I was resisting that for a very, very long time, because I didn't see how a free giveaway promotion fits into the idea of selling books, you know, of asking people, hey, pay for this because it's a worthy product. But now that I have a whole series, I see the wisdom in making the first book in the series something that is available, at least for a limited time, free. And so I decided, in honor of it being April, because it's a fool's month, it's a foolish time, I would give away the first book, Fool's Proof, as a free sample so that people can enjoy it and hopefully get hooked on the rest of the series. Well, I was not expecting how many people would get hooked on it. About over, I would say, close to 3,500 people so far have taken it. Yes. And I'm getting replies on Facebook from people. I'm getting replies on Reddit from people. I'm getting people who thank me for giving them a free book. I'm like, wow, I should be thanking you for giving me a chance and for reading my series. But it is a blast. It has hit the number one free Kindle book in, currently I see it in two categories, and it's number two in a third. And I was in the top 100 of all Kindle books recently, and that was so exciting because there's so many of them. There's millions of Kindle books. So that was a real blast. And these are not necessary categories that I thought of either. These are categories where Amazon felt that, hey, it's an absurdist fiction. And so it's number one absurdist fiction now. I'm really, really happy with how many people want to give my book a chance. So,
well, let me just ask you that. I was going to ask you that in a few minutes, but well, let's just discuss the non-writing things that writers have to do to support their own work. Because, like you said, you're more of a creative person. I think most writers probably are. I myself, you know, especially. You know, indie authors really have to do all of this because they don't have any like team of people, you know, like doing this. So assuming the writer has the talent to create a good book in the first place and or series to go along with it, what are some of those tasks that every writer, in your opinion, needs to get good at in order to promote their books?
Oh, Oh boy. You know what? That is tough because I'm still in the process of learning it all myself. But I think that one of the things, if you are a kind of person like me who likes making things, it's very, very tempting, I think, to get hooked on making ads and making posts and making promotions and making every single little thing and spreading yourself all over every possible avenue for self-promotion and every possible platform that there is for social networking and making videos and do that and trying everything. And I've heard that described as the proverbial throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing how much of it sticks. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's true. Looking back on it, I realized that probably was not the greatest idea. And so in this past year, I radically pulled back. I wasn't promoting the book literally at all for many months. And that alone teaches you something interesting because it'll teach you how much traction your book can get without any push behind it, which I was surprised that it actually did have a small but, you know, aggressive number of people who were into it, whether I mentioned the thing or not. So that was really kind of nice to know. But then I started moving one step at a time. I took a wonderful online course that explained Facebook ads. The different ad platforms are very difficult to understand sometimes because they're not necessarily user-friendly and they sometimes contradict one another and they have different aims and goals. So I pulled back completely from Amazon advertising. I decided I'm not going to use this at all. I'm going to focus on Facebook ads because I do have a lot of people that have known me on Facebook for a long time, and I'm going to try taking the advice of the marketing course that I used. Am I allowed to say who it is? Or
I wish you would, yeah.
Oh, it's Matthew J. Holmes. It's Facebook Ads for Authors. And he had a very, very persuasive point that the Facebook ads algorithm has finally got itself dialed into the point where it does what we had always hoped it would do, which is get out there and start foraging for an audience for you. His point is that you no longer have to try tinkering with choosing different audiences and trying to dial in the different kinds of demographics that you think might get your book. He's like, no, Facebook knows better than you do. And if you set the ad free and let their algorithm do the work, it will find your audience for you.
So this is just so I understand, because I've had a little bit of experience with Facebook ads, but I know you can like say what your audience is, or you can let Facebook like find it for you based on the parameters you set. Is that what you're saying? And that he's encouraging you to do that because Facebook knows better?
He's encouraging you, believe this or not, to not set any parameters at all. You can set a minimum age. Yes. He said, don't do anything. He said, set what country it's in, set what language it's in. If you have a minimum age for your books, please do set that. But after that, the Facebook algorithm goes into a learning phase, and it starts searching for the right place for your ad to be. And what you do is you give it a couple of different choices of creative. So you put in, and he said the number one lever you can pull, as he puts it in the lever in the lessons, is the creative itself. He said, let Facebook do what it does. What you do is you try and develop the best looking ads with the best content that appeals to your audience because it stops them scrolling. And so I did that. I created a couple of different images that I put into the ads. I created a few different headlines, a few different pieces of primary copy, as they call it, and then set them free. And they went nuts. It's just fascinating to me. I tune in. It's like watching a little garden grow. You click on the little ad, you know, dashboard, and it's like, oh, here's the people that saw this today. You know, which ones are working better with who? And you are tempted to fiddle. He said, you're tempted to fiddle with it and touch it and try to dial new hands off for at least 3 to 5 days at a time before you make any changes. And so in doing this one thing, I found it fascinating because it's reassuring to know that there are people out there who want your book. They've never heard of you. You know, it's true that it's free at this point. So the real test, I think, is going to come at the end of the month when I put it back on sale for a price. But this gives me really great hope because if they didn't want it, they wouldn't take it free or no. You know what right. I mean? They just scroll right by.
Right.
So yeah. And the fact that people are interacting with me about it is awesome as well, which is really cool. So that was a number one thing, the Facebook ads. The other thing that I found that was really, really productive for me, and it may not be productive for everyone, but for me, it's Reddit. And it's not advertising on Reddit. Yeah. It's chatting with people on Reddit, because I love to give, you know, like my perspective on different topics. You know, I'd like to share, you know, what I thought of stuff that's funny and make a wisecrack here and there, but also in all seriousness to interact with other writers and creatives when they're looking for a perspective or when they want an opinion or when they have questions that I know the answers to. I enjoy interacting on Reddit, and I've been doing that for many years. So what I did was on the advice of a very nice person who I met on Reddit, who I chat with every other week now, she's a marketing person. She did advise me to change my username to my real name, which is not often done on Reddit. That's not a very common Reddit thing to do. But the longer term payoff is that people will recognize you and be able to find you. And I discovered that after I've had a nice chat with somebody on Reddit, I go to look at my Amazon dashboard, let's say, and whoa, people taking the book, you know, they seek me out. They buy down the series. They don't just take the first book. They'll buy all four. And it's like, and you can immediately see it starts happening for me very soon after I've had a nice chat on Reddit. So that was a big surprise to me. I didn't expect that, because it's not usually seen as that kind of a platform.
And I'm curious, why Facebook you'd see more traction than on Amazon, mm-hmm. where people are already there looking for books. So yeah. That's very peculiar to me. How do you explain that? Like,
I have no idea. Honestly, I don't know. Other than that, I think it's possible that with Amazon, there's just such an overwhelming choice that they just offer so many thumbnails now. It used to be even that you had an Amazon series page and there were no books on there other than yours. And that used to be one of the great benefits. If you could direct, you know, browsers to your series page, ta-da, you would show them your entire series and it was all you. Now there's a whole series of also bots on the bottom there too, you know, and I'm just thinking that it's possible that Amazon is too overwhelming, or it's possible that the ads are different fundamentally in a way that I don't know how to use yet. Maybe I will learn it later down the line. But I am very surprised at how many people apparently must on Reddit look at my profile, because I put the link to the books in the profile. How else would they know who I am or who?
But you're not actively plugging your book on Reddit. You're just talking to people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mention it when it's appropriate. Most of the subs have a rule against self-promotion, so I won't talk about it. But if someone asks, then you can say it. And they often do. They're like, oh, where can I get your books? Oh, you know, tell me more. Like, it really is quite, you know, I really like it, because I do enjoy chit-chatting with people so much online. And I've met so many nice people like you, you know, they're out there. This is great.
Now, let me ask you, and if you don't want to answer this, I understand. But I'm just curious, as an indie author, like, how much should indie authors be looking to spend on advertisements on whatever given platform? You know, how much money needs to be invested in that?
That is tricky, because I'm running tests, so I'm not putting full bore money behind it at this time. Matthew J. Holmes does recommend that if you don't have about 10 or 20 pounds, he calls them because he's British, but you know, $10 or $20 per day to put into the Facebook ads, then you will not see the full power of their algorithm working.
Okay.
But that said, he said you can use any amount of money. And so I haven't been systematic with it, but I've been throwing a little bit here, a little bit there, and testing a few ads running at the same time. Ideally, after you've gotten all of the kinks out, you should have just two. And they should both be drawing from that same budget of, he said, 10 or 20 pounds minimum. So there's that. But like I said, it is possible to get a real lot of great traction out of stuff that is completely free, like just chatting with people. So I would say that you might need a little bit of a bringing money to the table in Vegas mentality, a little bankroll mentality, where you're not really afraid to lose the money, because you know that ads are going to eat some You know what I mean?
Right.
So I would say, yeah, you kind of maybe need to have a little bit of that gutsiness if you're going to use advertising. But the ideal is for it to bring you in more sales than it costs you to run the ads. So again, you have to be willing, right. I think.
No, yeah. That's helpful. I mean, $10 to $20 a day, not everybody can spend that, but it's helpful when you hear that. You know, I heard one guy, he's some kind of marketing expert. I forgot his name, but you know, he says like $10,000 will get your product, service, or whatever in the to the eyes of a million people, but it takes that much, you know. So then I'm like, man, that's a lot of money.
Is a lot of money. I mean, here I am. I used to work in an advertising agency. I mean, we were running back in the days when people ran ads in newspapers. You know what I'm saying? Like those kinds of ads and those kinds of budgets, you know, this is tiny baby stuff compared to that, obviously. Right. But when it's your own money, right, then it's different. When it's your client's money, you can be looking at all the zeros and it's
right. You know, and I worked for a company, they spent $15 million a month on advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're competing, you know, as an indie person, you know, think of like what the big publishers are doing. You know, they're you can't compete with it.
So. Oh, no. And the numbers that I mentioned, that's just what the minimum that it would take to get Facebook to start really activating its algorithm.
Gotcha.
You could obviously throw as much in there as you dare. You know, if you want to spend $10,000, there's nothing stopping you. It'll do it. They'll do it. So yeah, definitely. And I have so much to learn. I'm just getting started, but it is interesting to have kind of dialed all the way back and start from scratch and see what it's capable of, because it is fascinating that we've reached the point where it's going to do your work for you in that way. So
is there a particular social media that writers should be more invested in? Like, is it Facebook? You know, is Facebook, obviously for you, Facebook has proved to be a viable platform, but is there one platform that readers sort of gravitate toward over the other? You know, like, are more readers on Facebook than Instagram, for example?
Now, I really don't know about that, because my reader, Facebook tells me this, I have this demographic data, my readers are old compared to a lot of like the teen book talkers. Yes. Well, my main character in Fool's Proof, we have the main character, Malfred. He's in his mid-30s, but my other main character, a huge driver of the story, is 70 when the series begins. So I cannot help but think that maybe a demographic of readers sees themselves in her a little bit. So they are definitely on Facebook. Now, I've heard a lot about Book Talk. I've heard so much about it, and I've tried to get into it, but it hasn't resonated with me yet. And so the same with Instagram. You would think that I'm a natural for it because I'm an artist. So it's like, oh, it's the art platform. It's the visual platform. But I discovered about myself that I really am more of a writer in that way. I would rather chat with somebody in writing than show them images. I don't know why, but it's just how I am. So Facebook works for me possibly because of who I am, maybe more than who my readers are. But I do hear that Book Talk is the thing. So I don't know.
I've heard of it too, and I wasn't sure. Is it its own app or it's just like a section of TikTok?
Just a section of TikTok. It's like the TikTok-iverse where, and I don't know how much of it is about the reading of the books and how much of it is about the joy of owning books. Because so much of it seems to be about people who just plain love books. Like they love that they are books. They like to handle books. They like how they smell. They like being with them. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's... You know, there is that entire subset of people who genuinely love paperbacks and they're into it.
Have you experienced or have you experimented with Threads at all?
I am just starting. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know that's sort of Instagram's version of Twitter, so to speak. You know, it's a text-based thing. So I figured since you said you like text-based things, Threads seems to be, and Threads is a little more streamlined. I was never into Twitter to begin with, so I find myself struggling on Threads too to get into it. You know, like it's just not something, I don't know. There's certain platforms you go on and you're just like, I'm not into it, you know?
Totally. And the funny thing about Twitter is they gave me a little bit of an alert actually just yesterday. They said, this is your Twitter, or sorry, your X anniversary. Yeah. They said, 15 years with X. I'm like, wow, I didn't realize it, but I read about Twitter, right? In The Economist, I think it was when it came out. And I'm like, oh, this is something new. I'll try it. And then I ignored it for many years. But all that time I had been a Twitterer, I suppose. I just wasn't using it. But at the Midwest book, at the Midwest Writers Workshop was where I found that they said people in the publishing business were real huge users of Twitter. And they said it was a great way to reach other writers and a way to reach editors and a way to reach agents because they really, really loved zapping one another those little short messages when it was still just 140 characters, right. Much their thing. So I started using Twitter back then for that reason, but I didn't really use it either, to tell you the truth, Giancarlo. It was a little bit too bite-sized for what I wanted to do. And it also was very demanding of attention. Like, it kept interrupting me all day long, you know, so it wasn't really my thing. But I did start getting into it more lately because I had found a nice community of writers there, and they were really fun to talk to. Many have migrated to other places like Mastodon. I was there for a bit. Blue Sky, I gave it a try. A friend invited me over there. Threads seems to have a really, you know, big push behind it, obviously, because it's Meta. So that it might have more staying power. But yeah. I am trying it, so if you're trying it too, I'll see you over there.
Yeah, sure. I'm on there. I just you know, when I say I'm trying it, I don't spend a whole lot of time on there, you know. So I you know, it's interesting. I did this digital fast. Our church was doing this digital fast a couple months back, and when I came back, I had such a loss of interest for a lot of the social media stuff.
Oh, interesting. You detoxed from it. I love
right,
it.
Right. I detoxed, and I'm all like, good. Man, this is just a waste of time, you know? So I'm getting back a little bit into Instagram. That was like the main social media platform that I enjoyed, but, Yeah, there was a lot of it that I was just like, I don't know if this is worth it, you know, because as a writer, like, I went on these things like, oh, trying to promote it. So if I don't see certain traction in a platform and I'm not enjoying it myself, well, then it just lost its value to me, you know. So it's either going to serve me in some way in my business goals, or I have to, at a minimum, enjoy it.
You know? Yes, exactly. I think that's where Reddit is hitting for me, because I just, for some reason, I really just like the idea that you can pop into a place, regardless of whether you have followers or whether people know you or anything. It's just, you go in there because you want to talk about a subject. And that's why I am surprised that people bother to check my profile and then follow it up enough to, you know, check out the books and all that, because I'm like, oh, it's almost like a sweet added bonus, because that's not why they're there. They wanted an answer to a question, you know, they wanted to talk about a topic, and the fact that they follow up and find me afterwards is like, oh, that's just like a warm hug.
Now, does Quora have the same type of value as Reddit? Is it like a similar platform?
It used to. I really used to enjoy Quora. I used to Quora a lot, but I think it started to get, I don't know how else to describe this, but it started to get very much the feel of people just writing long things just to indulge themselves in it. You know what I mean? Like, it's the mood somehow changed. It didn't have that same user-centered, let's answer this question in good faith. You know, it's like, now it's just like, no, I feel like writing 10 pages about this topic. And so there.
Okay.
Like, they do. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the mood that I unfortunately got from Quora.
Now, you had mentioned that you got to number one in your particular genre. So can you get to number one on Amazon if you're giving away a book? Like, is it all about downloads? Yes. Oh, so that's
great. They have a top 100, and they have top listings for free and paid. So they are separate. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's so good to know for writers, because that's a good strategy to employ.
Yes, it really is, because that tells you whether people are interested in the book, not whether or not you're pricing it properly. It's a really, really good research tool, and that's why I decided to do it. And I'm so heartened by seeing, now it's true, people love free, and it's they'll download it, and they might never read it at the end of that. But if you get enough interest in it, that's okay, because it's an excellent gauge, I think, of how eye-catching the packaging is, how your description is, you know, does it entice someone to take it, you know? there's probably plenty of stuff out there. You know, there's stuff out there that you've seen that you wouldn't take it, even if it's free, right?
Right,
you're like,
right.
I don't need this. But it's nice to know that you're not that, you know? So whether or not it makes the transition when I put it back to full price, I don't know. But I will have learned a lot, I think, in this month.
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, I'm glad we touched on a lot of that, because there's mm-hmm. a lot of stuff that I myself was interested in knowing, you know, getting ready to, you know, to advertise my own book. So these are mm-hmm. all helpful stuff. Walk me through the process of writing a series, because at first it's an individual book and mm-hmm. you're just thinking of it as an individual book. And then you have several individual books. And now you said once the series is done, now you can kind of market that as one thing, as a single product. So kind of walk me through mm-hmm. that before we move on.
Sure. When I did the first book, it's true that at that time, I didn't have a plan of making a series out of it. And this happens a lot with writers, I think, is that some of them come in understanding fully that they plan to make a series and they're in it for the long haul right away. Others like me discover that they had so much fun writing the first book and that it ends on a note where you still have so much zest and joy to continue the same characters and the same world that it leads you to a series. So what I did after the first book was I took a good long, well, it wasn't long at the time. I was a lot more into running at the time. I was a half marathoner. This past few years, I've slacked it quite a little bit, but at the time, I was able to take a nice long run and think about the series and think about, okay, so the way I've left it in book one, what's the logical outgrowth of this, given the trajectory that I've set up with the way that the characters are, with the questions that were left unanswered, with the technologies of the world that I built and its geography and its culture? What is going to come next? And what's going to come after that and after that? So as I went on, my process is usually to build from an ending. And that is how I wrote the first book. The first thing I think of is the ending. I'm like, what mood do I want to leave my readers with? What can I do to hang everything from that? So in this, I thought, what's the last logical step in the outgrowth of this? And I worked my way back through it using those four steps. And I thought to myself, if every story has four parts, then does every series not also have four parts, right? So I developed what those four books should be. Yeah, exactly. So the first book is the setup, introduces the characters, introduces the world. If you dig it and you like it, you're going to want to read the next one. The second book, since that's the complication, and this is what's going to keep people coming back for the rest. Like, first one might be lightning striking. The second one has, if you hit the lightning twice, then you know people are going to be paying attention, right, for the third one. So I wanted to leave that second book on a cliffhanger. And my goal was to make someone scream and hurl it across the room and say, damn it, I want that third one now. And it's true. People did do that, which was so amazing. I had someone write a bad review because he hated cliffhangers so much. He's really? Like, where's the third one? You know, give it to me. I'm like, I love this. So anyway, there's that. The third book is the crisis and the question. So it's a big turning point, the third book. Something really big happens. I'm not going to give it away, but there's a big question mark at the end of that, right? And then the fourth book is the payoff. The payoff is these characters have come this far. Who are they now? What were we left with? What kind of outcome has this big question, this big turning point left for them? Now, I didn't end it fully in the sense that it's like, it'll never progress. I left a lot of little exit points all over the series because I love the idea of having a loosely interconnected world of books, like the Discworld books, where people can come at it and read different parts, like, you know how in the Discworld books, there's a series that has to do with the wizards at the university. There's a series that has to do with the witches. There's a series that has to do with the City Watch, right? All those different little parts. So now that this series of four is done, I have others that are tangentially related that I'm going to work on. Yes.
Same world.
Okay. Slightly different angles. Like there is, for instance, a series of cheap halfpenny pamphlets. They're like pulp novels in my books. And the characters buy these, you know, people are aware of them. And my husband's like, why don't you actually write them? I'm like, oh, That's a great idea. You know, they're like those novellas, like the James Bond novellas of the 50s, you know, the pulpy ones.
Yeah,
you know,
they had, like, the... J.K. Rowling did a bunch of that too.
Did she really? I love it. Love it.
Yeah, so the... I forgot. Like, but she, I'm trying to think, like, she would write like some of the manuals that they used in the Harry Potter thing, you know, and so, yeah, interesting. Yep.
And people like that kind of thing because, it, you know, it rounds out the world a little bit, and it also gives them like an in feeling like, oh, yeah, I know what this is, you know. And it's a standalone in the sense that they are going, obviously, they're going to be high enough quality and well enough crafted to be read alone. But at the same time, it adds to your understanding of what's gone before if you have read the rest. So that's just one angle. May or may not be the next thing I work on. We're going to wait and see. But yeah. Definitely, I left a lot of little out points.
So how do you explain that so many series are five books? Like, the whole four-point thing makes sense to me as far as four parts for one novel. And then it makes sense to me now that you're saying four books for the series. Mm-hmm. But so many, Percy Jackson, what else? There's a lot more in the Harry Potter series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But,
so how do you explain that? Like, do writers even have that in their heads, or do they just keep going until they feel done?
Honestly, I think my explanation is going to sound like it's just silly, but it's not silly. I think that the reason why there's five is because that looks good laid out. It does look good. When you have an odd number and there's one in the center, look at the next series that you see on Amazon, right? There's three. There's a big one in the middle, one little one poking out on either side, or one big one in the middle, two poking out, one big one, three poking out. Odd numbers look good. They just, I mean, that's, and again, and that's actually something I put in my notes was to discuss my new covers. I changed my covers last year because first off, I'm an artist and I wanted to freshen it up a little bit, but also because things do have to look good at a thumbnail size. And in the 4 years since I wrote these books, the trend toward the covers had become even more graphic. The lettering got really large, handcrafted, and brush lettering had gotten really large, and colors became a little bit brighter. And the covers that I had before were like a spoof of the Bayeux tapestry. They were embroidery looking, very detailed, very cute. And when you see them in, you know, the paperback version, you can open them up and it's a wraparound cover and you see all the characters and everything. It's really great. But I wanted something that looked better at a thumbnail size. And I think a lot of the covers are developed for that reason, to catch someone's eye as they browse quickly on a screen and to look good when they're laid out that way in an odd-numbered series.
So again, that's some more non-writing things that writers have to
maybe
be aware of. So
that's my thought. I don't know. I might be wrong, but
I mean, it makes sense. And I even like your idea of, like, if you have an odd number and you have the center book and then there's an equal number on each side of the center. I never even thought about that. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I have four for my reasons, but it makes me sad that there's no real eye-catching way to display four books if you don't have much room. Yeah,
right.
It's tough to lay them out.
Now, moving on, you have a term that you were talking to me about that you call small-scale fantasy, and you proposed it replace something more commonly known as cozy fantasy. So why don't you tell me why you feel the change is needed and what exactly this genre is?
Okay, so first off, I want to say there's nothing at all wrong with the term cozy fantasy, right? So please, if you're a cozy fantasy fan out there, do not feel that I'm trying to erase the terminology and get rid of it. It's absolutely adorable, and it does refer to a specific kind of writing that is indeed extremely popular and getting more so. In fact, just the other day, I was doing a little bit of research because I'm going to present a short talk at the American Library Association trade show this June in San Diego on this topic of small-scale fantasy. So I wanted to understand how the term cozy fantasy came to be, just so that I can come to grips with exactly what it refers to and why I propose small-scale fantasy. And the reason why I propose the term small-scale fantasy, possibly as a supplement to it, and in some cases a replacement, is because the word cozy itself is not necessarily what the readers who are looking for this are trying to get. There are a certain number of cozy readers who are literally looking for the hallmarks of coziness, which on the Reddit Cozy Fantasy, they do a little talk about it. And they ask each other, what is it that we want to see when we, or what is it that we want to read when we read Cozy Fantasy? And there includes a checklist that has things on it like embroidery and cats and baked goods and so forth and warmth. And those are very cozy things. But the truth is, in a poll that they recently put on Cozy Fantasy itself, the things that people actually wanted to find in Cozy Fantasy were low stakes, gentle conflict, right? Relatable, ordinary protagonists, and plots that are less than epic. They're a slice of life, or they have personal stakes for the characters. And to me, what that's saying is that it's not necessarily comfort that people want. What they want is they want a plot that is smaller scaled. They want a story that you don't need to draw a chart of all the characters in and draw family trees and consult a map every time you want to figure out what's happening. They don't want to see 50,000 creature armies clashing over months. They don't want to see political intrigues on a grand scale. What they want to see is a small cast of characters who they can easily keep track of doing things that are a sensible scale to normal life. So whether it's low stakes, the term low stakes is often used, and I feel that's a little bit dismissive because even the smallest actions can be immensely important to a character, especially if it's properly written. I said a lost button can be an epic thing to them, but I feel like this concept of a small scale fantasy is time has come because it's not necessarily comfort and coziness and friendliness and warmth that people want. Sometimes they do want drama. Sometimes they do want action. Sometimes they do want adventure and conflict. They just don't want it to overwhelm them when they read. They want to read for entertaining purposes, not to tax their minds with yet another thing that requires such a terrible lot of attention. So that would be my point. And I'm hoping that this branches out because it has implications in other genres as well, not just in fantasy.
Right. And so it's something more intimate and relatable is what they're looking for.
Yes. Almost like, you know, like chamber music as opposed to the whole orchestra kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And why the term small scale fantasy, which I like better. It just sounds cool.
I think small scale because I don't want to imply that it's low stakes in the sense that it's unimportant. And low stakes is a term that's often used in conjunction with cozy fantasy. I think it was Travis Baldry invented it. And it's an excellent way to contrast that type of writing with the typical, the universe hangs in the balance in a world where blah, 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 you know, like that. Mm-hmm. Yes. The idea of low stakes, very comfortable. You don't need to worry. There's not that much at stake. But at the same time, I'm afraid that dismisses a lot of, of importance to the characters. You know, these things aren't low stakes to them. These things are worth fighting for, to what degree there's going to be fighting in that story. And sometimes there's a lot of fighting. In some of these, a regular argument actually on the Cozy Fantasy subreddit is whether there can be violence or whether there can be a threat or whether there can be danger and still have it be cozy. So this is something that people definitely do spend time thinking about and talking about. And I feel that the term small scale might cover those bases without writing anything off.
Are there major popular works that fall in this genre that like average people would be aware of? Or is it like a real specific genre that you have to be into it to know?
You mean cozy fantasy or do you mean small scale?
So, well, now I'm confused. Didn't you say they're the same thing?
Yes and no, because I think that cozy has implications that narrow it. So when you hear the word cozy, people who are into cozy, they do actually have a list of cozy classics. And, some of them include The Hobbit, some of them include things like The Princess Bride, yes, I'm reading from a kind of cozy list of classics and ephemera that was actually listed on, let's see here.
I'm surprised to see The Hobbit is not considered like an epic tale.
I know, right? So this was actually, this list was compiled several years ago. So, and it was only from one particular angle. This was from Windgraph magazine, which was one of the original cozy fantasy champions, but their listing of it might be very different from someone else's. And so I think that the word cozy, being that you can argue what it means, this is why I suggest small scale. You know, it, instead. And it doesn't have to be just small scale fantasy. So there was a little chit chat where someone asked, can small scale be, what would a cozy, there's no such thing. They were saying there's no such thing as a cozy thriller, right? But I said, hey, but you know what? You definitely can have a small scale thriller, because one of the most amazing thrillers of all time is The Eye of the Needle. And what could be smaller scale than that? We've got one spy who knows one secret that could change the whole war, and he ends up on one lonely little island with one woman, one man, and a little boy, right? That is about as small scale, I think, as it gets. And yet that is the most gripping thriller. So there's, I think, a really good reason to use these terms.
Right. And since you distinguish the two, is there something in the small scale front that you would considered like a major work? You said like The Hobbit would be considered cozy fantasy.
Yeah, or maybe it's cozy. I don't know. I'm not sure I would say that, but that's it's literally was listed in one of the
I guess it's interpretive.
List.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So small scale, since it's just emerging, I really would like to know what other people think of this, whether they think it's viable and what they have to say about it. So for that reason, I started a subreddit called Small Scale Fantasy. So it's r/small scale fantasy. Currently, that is a very small scale subreddit itself. I don't even think we've reached 20 people yet. But when it started, cozy fantasy was a little like that too. It leaped up overnight in May of 2022. It just went boom, you know, from like 10 people to like 2,000 in a month. And I know that's because cozy fantasy was having a real, real moment in 2022 for some reason. It just, that was the moment for it. You know, its time had come.
Right.
So I'm trying to kind of start this movement because I want to hear from people ahead of my talk. I'd like to know whether what I'm saying resonates with them, or whether I'm the only one that thinks so, or whether they feel that it has legs and will become a good industry descriptor or not. I really would like to know. So for that reason, I started the group.
Cool. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll try to make sure I get that link to put in the show notes as well, so the listeners can check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Just about wrapping up, I know I've asked you this probably two times already, but I forgot your answer, so
that's okay.
I'm going to ask again. Maybe it's changed. If you could have one superpower, what would it be and why?
Oh my gosh, and I remember never really knowing how to answer this. Right. Oh my God, that is such a tough question. Oh, the one that I kind of find myself wanting to say, and then I find myself thinking maybe I don't really want it, is the power to see the future. But you know what? That is a tough thing, because part of you is like, yeah, I'd always make great decisions. And then part of you is like, no, there's maybe a reason why it's good not to know what's coming. So can I leave that as an example of a superpower that could go either way?
Yeah, it could be undecided. I agree. Knowing the future may be a good or horrible thing.
Yes. Let us hope that there's only good things in our future. I know that's not possible, but let's hope it anyway.
Right. So if people wanted to follow you, Ava, if they wanted to buy your books, reach out to you, whatever, where can they go about doing all of those good things?
Probably the easiest place to remember is evasandor.com. It's evasandor.com. There I have links to buy my books, either directly from me or from all the major booksellers. You'll find links out to them. You'll also find some other things, like things that I've blogged about now and then, or art that I have drawn, or that you can buy t-shirts of the imaginary universities from my books, or other stuff, whatever I feel like putting there. But that's probably the easiest place to catch up with me. And you can look for me by name on the social media networks that we've talked about, like for instance on Facebook, there is Ava Sandor Books. On Instagram, the same. Threads, same thing. X, Twitter. And I am around. I'm trying to dial back, but you can find me by name just about anywhere.
And Ava Sandor Books is pretty much your social media handle on all the different platforms.
Yes, cool. Very easy to find me by name.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Story King podcast a third time. Always a pleasure to have you.
You are very welcome. It's always fun to do this with you.
Thank you for listening to the Story King podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at storyking.podcast or facebook.com/storykingpodcast. We're also on TikTok and YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a positive review on the platform of your choice and share with your friends and family. To further support the show, consider becoming a patron for as low as $1 per month and gain access to exclusive content on patreon.com/TheStoryKing. You can purchase the literary works of Giancarlo Gadini on Amazon.com. All of these links will be in the show notes. Thanks again for listening to the Story King podcast, a show about people and their stories. Please join us next time. Until then.